From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made at a recent conference on belief and unbelief hosted by the journal Salmagundi. James Wood tells the story in a new piece for The New Yorker. At the conference, the novelist and essayist Marilyn Robinson admitted that while she knows some good people who are atheists, she doesn't really get what it's all about. She doesn't find meaning in atheism. And she said, quote, "I have yet to hear the good atheist position articulated. I cannot engage with an atheism that does not express itself," end quote. Well, as Wood writes in The New Yorker, a new book provides exactly what someone like Robinson might be looking for. The author is Swedish philosopher Martin Hägglund, and his book is called This Life, Secular Faith and Spiritual Freedom. In my estimation, the book carries essentially three main pillars, and the first is about meaning. Now, it's not uncommon to hear religious people say that their faith gives them meaning, and they find that atheism makes everything random or meaningless. Hägglund finds it entirely the opposite. He writes that if you believe in everlasting life, your focus is on some hazy idea of a future paradise, you don't find meaning in what's happening here, or at least not as urgency. The here and now is more urgent to him, he says, if you abandon the hope of everlasting life. You could understand why every day would matter, would have meaning. Describing his annual trip home to northern Sweden, he writes, quote, "When I return to the same landscape every summer, part of what makes it so poignant is that I may never see it again. Moreover, I care for the preservation of the landscape because I am aware that even the duration of the natural environment is not guaranteed. Likewise, my devotion to the ones I love is inseparable from the sense that they cannot be taken for granted. Our time together is illuminated by the sense that it will not last forever, and we need to take care of one another because our lives are fragile," end quote. The second idea that Hägglund offers is that he thinks many religious people are unknowingly secular. That's because Hägglund says their understandable fear of death and their desire to be reunited with lost loved ones is a human impulse, but their vision for what everlasting life looks like is simple. It's an extension of this life. Maybe with more gardens, but it's a desire for not unending time, but just more time on earth, more time with loved ones. But if we actually have eternal life, Hägglund argues, it removes meaning from daily interaction because we're unconcerned with whether we'll have more of it in the future. And finally, Hägglund writes that we should reevaluate our economic systems because what is most valuable is the freedom of time. And Hägglund says that when we have such inequality, the most precious resource is hoarded by people with wealth. They're free to spend many hours or days or months doing as they please. When people live in poverty, they have very little time to pursue their own desires in life. So Hägglund is calling for radical economic change to allow for more equal access to free time. Now, that's a lot to take in. And whether you're an atheist or not, we invite your feedback this hour as we discuss meaning and more with our guests in the studio. Lawrence Torricello is here. He's an associate professor in the Department of Philosophy at RIT. Welcome back here. Thank you for being here.
Thank you, Evan. Always glad to be here.
And with us is Matthew Brown. He's a family doctor in Rochester. And because it's Matthew's first time on the program, and the rumor is he rerouted his schedule today, I'm going to read your full title one time because you deserve that. Family practitioner in Rochester since 2005, expanded work to include chemical dependency and addiction treatment in 2015. 2017, you got into politics, came within a few hundred votes of becoming the first Democrat in a century to be elected to the Parenton Town Board. And while you failed in that initial attempt, you were elected to the Fairport Village Board last year, where you serve as a trustee. Did we get it?
That is all correct. Thank you, Evan.
Thank you for rerouting your schedule, and thank you for being here.
Oh, my pleasure.
This is obviously a lot to take in, but I kind of want to take it piece by piece here, or perhaps pillar by pillar, because I do think Hägglund is right in one way. I think in the last couple of decades, we've seen a number of atheist writers, Sam Harris, Christopher Hitchens, Richard Dawkins among them, who are sort of called the new atheists. And they take a lot of, they spend a lot of time sort of kind of trying to debunk religion or kind of take people through why religion is false. And Hägglund's sort of uninterested in that. He thinks, really, this is about understanding just the human desire for time and the human desire for time with loved ones and the desire to pursue free time. And that's actually quite secular, and that meaninglessness is more in this assumption of everlasting life, which turns it on its head. And Larry, I want to start with you on this. I do think he's right to say this, that is at least, it's new for now. Mm-hmm. As you pointed out before the hour began, some of these ideas are everything old is new again. But mm-hmm. at least in the last couple of decades, it's a very different look at atheism to me. Mm-hmm. What do you think?
Yeah, I think that's a really important place to begin, contrasting what this book is doing against what's become very popular with the new atheist movement. And also, I understand a lot of YouTube channels are dedicated to this sort of thing now.
Yes.
For better or for worse. But I think that Hegland is doing something a lot more nuanced and with a longer philosophical, historical sort of lineage that is worth remembering and going back to.
Yeah, so when we talk about that lineage, I mean, you as a philosopher yourself and a professor of philosophy, you can probably pick them off the shelf, but what are some names that come to mind? What are some themes and names?
Well, you know, it was, we could start, you know, all the way back with Plato and Socrates and the idea of whether or not death is a good or a bad thing. At the very end of Socrates' death, he says that he owes a chicken to Asclepius, the physician, for the cure that's now, you know, coming to him. So, I mean, we could argue if that's a very good attitude about death or life, but of course, Camus, is probably someone we should talk about at some point, because I think a lot of what, at least I read in the review of Hegland's book, really resonates with readings of the myth of Sisyphus and the notion of the absurd and our wrestling with finitude in temporality, which seems to really be what Hegland is really focusing on here. And this is, in a way, philosophical bread and butter for many of us, going back to, you know, what made us fall in love with philosophy as undergrads.
Yeah, and I think it was, I think the piece quotes Pliny the Elder, among others, who kind of talked about the horror of everlasting life, the idea that that death, number one, relieves us of the need to worry and care and perhaps suffer, but also the assurance that we get to go back to that same lack of worry that we had in oblivion before life. Do you share Pliny the Elder's thoughts on that, Larry?
I suppose, in a sense, if one is comforted by the idea of oblivion.
It's a harsh word, I get it. It's kind of carries some connotation.
I'm reminded of Epicurus, who famously said that, you know, when I am, death is not. When death is, I am not. So, in a way, the two shall not meet, and no need to fear death, because we won't know it when we're dead. And I guess that is comforting to some people. I don't think it's really, truly, sincerely enough to make many of us not fear death.
Yeah, but I'm more with you there. And Paul Fidalgo, who works for an organization, I'm trying to try to remember, and Megan Mack will correct me because Paul has helped us on the program. Paul Fidalgo works for a Washington organization that we've had on the program before, and he responded to Adam Frank from the University of Rochester several years ago when Adam Frank basically made that argument that, hey, no worries. We're just going back to where we were in 1700, wherever you were, which is nowhere. And Paul's going, yeah, but now I know what life is, and I think it's pretty great, and I'd like it to continue even as an atheist. So I take Larry's point that there's not just easy comfort. He works for the Center for Inquiry, by the way. So, Matthew, how do you take that question of meaning? And let me ask you directly then. If someone in your life says, look, I'm spiritual and I find meaning in my relationship with God and knowing that I'm going to be reunited with loved ones and that there is more life to come, that's where meaning is for me. Where do you find meaning? How do you answer that?
Well, I don't know that I have to answer someone else's belief per se. You know, I don't know that it's my job as, you know, kind of a lay atheist to take belief away from people. The way that I see this framed is more of kind of a concentration of where you put your focus. You know, if you believe that death is just the beginning, if you believe that you have eternity after that, then what we have here on Earth is actually a very small percentage of your overall experience. If you think that when you die, that is the end, then this becomes 100% of the experience, which is, you know, infinitely more. So if you're going to focus on something and this is all you have, I think that's going to lend you, it's going to kind of make you focus a bit more on what is here. You know, if the total amount of beauty that you're going to experience is spread out over millennia, then that's much more distilled than the beauty that you can notice during the years that we have on this earth.
Yeah, in a moment I'll take a phone call from our first call from Rich, who's going to talk about urgency. In your own work as a physician and as someone who's moved into politics, do you think that your atheism actually imbues you with more urgency?
That's a really interesting question. I think it might. I think it certainly has helped me in some ways and probably hindered me in other ways in terms of connecting with patients. In terms of urgency, you know, I've definitely been guilty of trying to, at some points in my career, extend life, you know, at the cost of quality of life. And I think that's something a lot of physicians do fall into, but I think as an atheist physician, it's something that I have to be a lot more conscious of doing.
Sure. And when you talk about beauty, I like that the New Yorker piece pointed to Louise Gluck, the poem Field Flowers, narrated from the perspective of a flower, which is chiding its human visitors for thinking about eternal life instead of just looking at the flowers. And Gluck writes, "Your poor idea of heaven, absence of change. Better than Earth? How would you know, who are neither here nor there, standing in our midst?" You relate to that, it seems.
I do. It's funny. I remember very specifically in college, it was a comparative vertebrate anatomy class, and just getting an idea, just, you know, looking out at all the different skeletons and, you know, seeing how perfectly they were adapted to their purposes, and just that beauty of understanding, and took a step back and said, you know, this, like, the beauty that I'm seeing right now, this should be enough. You know, I don't know why I was thinking about religion at the time, but just to say, it's nice that people look for something that is not here, but really everything we have here is so fantastic. Why are we not looking more at this?
And listeners, I invite phone calls, feedback from people, obviously, of all perspectives here. Certainly welcome. Connections at WXXI.org if you want to email. Connections at WXXI.org. You can call the program 844-295-TALK. It's toll free, 844-295-8255. 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. And I certainly don't want to create this false choice that, you know, well, atheists will appreciate beauty on this earth, and people who are religious are always thinking about the life to come. That's not at all the point I'm trying to make, though. You know, if you read, for example, St. Paul's Epistle to the Colossians, where St. Paul writes, "Set your minds on things that are above, not on things that are on earth. For you have died, and your life is hidden with Christ in God." And the idea of focusing on God, focusing on prayer, focusing on building that faithful relationship and the attention and the energy and the life to come. So it's complex. We'd love to hear from you, and we're going to start with Rich on the phone first. Go ahead, Rich.
Hey, Evan, how are you doing today?
Good, yeah, very good. Go ahead.
There's so many things to talk about on this subject. You could go forever. I've been basically a vowed atheist for the last 35 years of my life. And the thing that I find atheism does is several things that it does. Number one, my morality becomes my responsibility. I have to challenge myself every day to be better. Once you take that on, take that responsibility, that gives your life a level of meaning. Does it make it more complicated, more complex? Yeah. Also, as we live on this earth, my meaning comes from this urgency to make this earth better for my grandson, my nieces and nephews, and just the world and better. As I look around, I can't look at some, well, you know, in the by and by, life will be better. What does that mean to me? Even I, in speaking to what he said, where many religious people have atheistic views too, they sort of feel the same way. They just don't know how to deal with it. And I understand, coming from a very, very religious family, it gives you a way of balancing and, you know, balancing the scale, saying, you know, it sucks here, but maybe later. But there's so many questions about the later, like, who do you meet? If someone died 30 years ago, who do you meet in heaven? All these things. I can go on, but the challenge of being better every day here and giving my and enjoying the things and the beauty, but then also being concerned about the changes, the disconcerting changes that are happening as my child, my grandchild grows up. I think that all ties into it. So my life in many ways becomes more complex and I have to take on more, but then there's a huge reward in that too.
Rich, thanks for that phone call. I'll let our guests respond. Professor Torchello first. Go ahead.
Well, thank you, Rich. I think that atheism is bound up with morality. You know, one of the things that probably annoys atheists is the assumption that you can't be moral as an atheist. As a moral philosopher, I think that the opposite, a good case could be made for the opposite. And I don't put that out there as a challenge to theists, but the idea that one has to take responsibility for one's own actions and the consequences of those actions, and they have no metaphysical shield to hide behind. The idea that we're trapped in this finitude where we have to focus on the lives of those around us and those we interact with, and we can't shirk responsibility or offload it to some deity who could, you know, write things for us. For me, the attraction to atheism has always been ethical. I've always struggled with the notion that one could reconcile all of the, there's wonderful things in this earth, but all of the bad things and suffering on the planet with a deity. So it's that old-fashioned problem of evil, I think, has never sufficiently been answered for me.
I would also just add to that, the looking at the inequality and suffering, just outright suffering in our world, there is a risk of complacency if we say, well, it's God's will.
Exactly. Yeah. Or why should we accept God's will? I mean, this is the ultimate heresy, I suppose, if you're, you know, steeped in theism. But it seems to me, and I, again, I don't mean to be flippant, and I imagine theists would you know, be offended by some of this, but it's always seemed that at least the Judeo-Christian God that many of us are raised to believe in is a bit of an abusive parent in its relationship with us. I think there are lots of parallels to that analogy. The extremity of worship and, you know, the need, the sort of need of constantly bowing the knee to this being, and the sorts of things that we're asked to accept as something that we're meant to learn from. We wouldn't accept this sort of thing among other human beings if there really were a parental sort of figure treating children in the way that we accept that our deity treats us. It seems quite abusive to me. But I think that's also a very crude view of religion. And though many people hold this personification of, you know, this sort of personal sense of a deity with personal identity, I know there are other forms of religion that sort of attempt to get around that. But speaking to a very common notion of God, it seems that all of the ethical arguments are on the side of the atheist.
I want to ask Matthew a question on both from your perspective as an atheist, but as your perspective as a doctor. Mm-hmm. There is an interesting, to me, it's interesting that when you look at the cases like Terri Schiavo, I'll take that as one example, mm-hmm. in which the medical community is expressing one thing about a person's condition, about the condition of someone's brain, as in her case, unfortunately, the way that her family would describe it, they wanted her to kind of come back, to kind of be restored to the person they knew before. There, I'm trying to be fair about this. It seems to me that the people most likely to call for every possible medical intervention to extend life, to not allow death, are the same people who think that there is an afterlife and a paradise to come. And I think Hagelin would say, peel that back. That's actually just sort of a closet secularism revealing itself there, that deep down you know this may be the end of time. And that's a natural human fear, mm-hmm. that's not something to be ashamed of. But also don't be fearful of confronting the secularism therein. Do you agree with that?
So I think a fear of letting go is something that kind of transcends religion versus non-religion. I think if you truly do believe in an afterlife, then it may be easier to let go. But that doesn't mean that it's easy.
Let go yourself, maybe.
Yes.
But the difference is not wanting to let go for a family member or a friend.
Right, exactly. And I think part of the problem with the situation that you're describing is if you talked to the people involved, and I'm completely, you know, projecting here, but they were probably still holding out hope for a miracle. And that does kind of play back into religion. That, you know,
that's a fair point.
The doctors don't know everything, and I'd be the first to admit that, you know, the human body is the most complicated machine I will ever experience, and I know very little about it. That's not to say I'm not a good doctor. I'm just, you know, I'm very cognizant of my own limitations.
You know what you don't know. Yeah,
exactly.
Sure.
So, you know, as much as doctors, we very rarely say 100%. You know, we'll say, you know, we are very sure, but we can never say 100%. So if you're saying to someone, your loved one is very likely never going to wake up, very likely never going to is not the same thing as never.
And if you believe in miracles, the door is open to pray.
Exactly.
But the extension to that, and again, I'm trying to channel Hagland here, is that closet secularism kind of reveals itself when you almost never hear someone praying for the regeneration of a lost limb. For example, a soldier comes home from war and has lost a leg. Family doesn't pray that God, they're going to wake up and God will have you put your leg back on you. Even though if you believe in miracles, then maybe you believe that's possible. But Hagland says deep down, you're praying for things that are still mildly statistically possible, not the fully impossible, because in the back of your brain, there's a secularism. That's Hagland's argument. On the medical side, does that carry weight with you?
I think it would. You know, I don't necessarily see patients ask for the impossible. You know, I see patients who are distraught. You know, I see patients who ask me to pray with them. I don't see patients asking me, you know, please take this condition away from me when I can't.
And I think Professor Torchella would step in and say that even in Terry Schiavo's case, if the doctor said it is extremely unlikely to the highest degree that we know of a return to brain function, a return to brain function would not definitionally be a miracle if there is even the smallest statistical chance that it could happen, right?
Absolutely. As long as there's a natural explanation that we can turn to, which is going to be more reasonable, all things considered, than the supernatural explanation. Occam's razor points us in that direction.
Yeah.
I'm going on David Hume's definition of a miracle here, which is actually the idea that such a thing can't really exist and that this relegates belief to the realm of faith, which is your willingness to abandon reason, your willingness to move over into that other domain. It's, in a way, it's an embrace of your ignorance. That's very different than the idea that, as you're saying, that one is going to be praying for things that are no longer statistical. I suppose that's where Hagland says this is secular. I'm not sure I follow Hagland in the sense that I know why that should be secular, or why we should put the label secular on that as opposed to theological. I suppose, I mean, there's a bifurcation there that I'm not sure needs to be made, but I take the point that deep down people know what's possible and what's not possible, and they don't pray for the impossible.
And so one other point before I get back to your phone calls, I hope that everyone listening, no matter where you are in your own belief and perspective, takes this as just an exploration of Hagland's themes and where our guests are, and not a maligning of people of faith. I mean, if someone does pray for the regeneration of a lost limb, who can blame you? If number one, you're a person of faith, you believe in miracles, and you have a hard time accepting. I mean, human beings do a lot of things out of pain, out of suffering, out of hope, out of fear. This isn't meant to malign, I hope. And I guess I just kind of want to put that point. And I don't at all hear that from Matthew or Larry. But I think that maybe goes a little bit against. But I don't know, Matthew. Maybe you find yourself a fan of the New Atheists in recent decades. I don't know. Were you?
You know, I thought they had some interesting things to say. I thought, you know, there's a bit of kind of a bite to what they were saying, and I know some people kind of enjoyed that. I've never found that to be a decent way to hold a civil conversation. I think, you know, religion is such a personal thing on both sides, whether you believe in, you know, an accepted religion or whether you consider yourself an atheist. Someone coming at you with, you know, you're wrong and here is why you're wrong, very rarely results in convincing anyone with something that really doesn't have a lot of proof behind it. I mean, proof is not what gets people to be religious. If I could go back to one thing from the caller, I'm sorry to
redirect
here. So, you know, I very much appreciate his statement that, you know, when you are an atheist, you know, you have to create your own morality. And I feel like that's been phrased as a very good thing. And certainly I hope I've created a morality for myself that most people would see as good. But I think it's also a very complicated idea, because I think we all know people who, you know, might not be the best people if they didn't think there was someone looking over their shoulder. I think Hagelin does make, you know, kind of mention of socialism in his book and in the article that they're referencing. But, you know, the fact is that people who have a lot are not going to be very likely to give it up. And, you know, the idea of someone looking over your shoulder, if that is something that, you know, kind of encourages you to give up things that you would not otherwise to people who really don't have enough, that's not the worst thing in the world. And I would hope that atheism would lead people to the same idea. But if there's not a carrot and a stick, I think we as humans are very used to the idea of carrots and sticks. And there's so much immorality that is grayer than that.
It's such an interesting point. I'm going to ask Larry to follow up on one point there, and then we're going to spend the rest of our time on the myriad listener feedback already in. Professor Torcello, on that subject of the haves and have-nots that Matthew's referencing, this is a big issue for Hagelin, because his book, it takes an interesting pivot that maybe a lot of people aren't expecting. He takes his atheism and feels that it leads him to a call for socialism, because he feels that the real precious resource is freedom of time, because it is finite, it is ending, it is not everlasting, and those who have the most means hoard it, and they thus have freedom of time that many others don't have and will never have. And he wants an egalitarian society that offers freedom of time. Is there a logical extension when we look at economic systems based on his atheistic values?
Well, I think that the idea, I think that's exactly right. The idea is that if time is what's important, we want to free up our time. We want to have more leisure time to experience the things in life that we value and that give us meaning, and we don't want that to be stolen away. I don't know that necessarily leads right into socialism, but I think there are many good arguments for egalitarian socialistic frameworks in politics, and indeed liberal frameworks that include an emphasis on social welfare and egalitarianism. But I think we also want to focus on the notion or in the importance of liberal protections and the limits of reason when we're talking about politics that come out of all of this. Because one of the points that philosophers have made historically, and that seems like Hagelin is also making, is that we can't have a coherent idea of what eternity is. In a certain sense, we can't draw meaning from that, or we kid ourselves when we think we are, because we're imagining things that a finite mind is ill-equipped to imagine. And so one of the unfortunate things, going back to New Atheism and the YouTube revolution of atheism, if I can call it that, is what seems to me a fetishizement of reason. And what I think reason should be about when it informs our politics is its own limitations, the limits of reason, which is why I think it's important to carve out space for freedom of religion, space for all of us to explore, even have experiments in lifestyles, to reference John Stuart Mill in On Liberty. All of this is rooted in sort of an understanding of what we can't know, an understanding of our own limitations, and the need to provide lots of room and lots of space, including space for religion, for us to try to find that fulfillment. So the danger of talking about political reforms is that the more convinced we become of our own recipe for the good life, the more we might forget about the own limitations of our political knowledge and reason. And so I'm not accusing Hagelin of that. I haven't read the book, as I say. But I think I want to be very cautious about drawing any strong political conclusions from the insight that we can't really make a coherent sense of eternity.
A call for a little more humility.
Sure.
I want to get our only break of the hour, and we'll come back to your feedback. You're hearing Professor Lawrence Torchello from RIT, a professor in the Department of Philosophy. Matthew Brown is here, a family doctor in Rochester, sharing his perspective, and your emails and phone calls next. I'm Evan Dawson. Monday on The Next Connections, our final conversation with candidates for Rochester City School Board before the primary. That's first hour. In our second hour, a young United Methodist made headlines earlier this year when he pleaded for the church to accept him and his LGBTQ peers. The church then voted to uphold its ban on LGBTQ clergy and same-sex marriage. We talked to J.J. Warren, who is visiting Rochester on Monday. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Kevin writes to us to say, this ties into the religious right's refusal to take climate change seriously, largely due to evangelicals' focus on the next life rather than this one. That's from Kevin. Larry?
Amen.
Did you just say amen?
Yeah. So
I see what you did there.
This gets back to, in a way, what I was saying about humility. You know, the thing that bothers me isn't religion in and of itself, but I think what's really important for all of us, religious and secular alike, is to protect the public space for all of us to interact. And when you have the interpretation of science through a religious lens like we have in this example, this is really harmful to all of us, and there's no justification for it at all. I don't have any quick and easy solutions, but this is something that we should all be worried about. And I think the same thing is coming up with abortion right now. The idea that theological values can somehow dictate our legislation and even our interpretation of science, this is the real danger of a crude and clumsy use of religion. Religion isn't the enemy. That sort of ham-fisted religion mixed with politics is the true danger.
Matthew?
Yeah, I think, I don't know if I would blame the religious right specifically. I think a lot of people do a lot of things that hurt the earth in a lot of ways, and some of it's unknowingly and some of it's to their personal profit. I think it's a lot easier if you think that there's more important things than this coming up. You know, I have a low-key passion for environmentalism. My undergraduate degree is in forestry biology, so it's something I've been thinking about for a long time. But yeah, I think if you know this is all you have, then maybe you'll do a little bit better job protecting it. But I think there's also the flip side of that, which is that if you know there's no punishment for doing wrong, you might also not do as well as you could.
This is where the professor's going to hammer back at that one.
Yes.
Well, I don't know if I'm hammering back at it, but I just wanted to quickly point out that I think even from a religious point of view, most people agree that we're ethically obligated to act on climate change, which is why they attack the science, because the ethical arguments are so airtight. They would have a much harder time arguing that if climate change is actually happening and human beings are causing it, that we ought not to do anything about it. Now, some people try to, and they're terrible arguments that are made. So it's really remarkable that they take the easier strategy to challenge science rather than morality on the topic of climate change.
Herman in Brighton, next on the phone. Go ahead, Herman.
Hi. There's a lot to say, and I'll try to be brief. First of all, there seems to be a misconception. It's a widespread misconception, and I haven't read the book, but it seems to be reflected in your introduction. And there's a widespread misconception that religion in general is primarily about the afterlife. First of all, I'm fairly sure that there are some religions do not have the concept of afterlife.
True.
And there are a lot of religions, including mine, Judaism, where afterlife is the concept exists, but it's peripheral. It's not the focus of the religion, and a lot of people in my religion don't, and myself included, don't believe in an afterlife. The focus in Judaism is on this life, and religion. The scripture and the religious law is basically guidance as to how to live this life and how to behave towards others, how to treat the poor and the stranger, and so on. Religion, and this leads to the idea that religion is a counterbalance to the human tendency for selfishness. Religious law mandates us to treat people, even people that we dislike or people that we don't particularly care about, in a decent way. I mean, one example is the law in the Torah that if you see your enemy's animal fallen by the wayside, you shouldn't ignore it. You should help him get that animal back up again. Another aspect of religion is that you don't have to reinvent the wheel in every generation because religions have long traditions. The difficult questions of ethics and morality that we still deal with, and every generation will deal with, have been hashed out by great minds in the past, and the religious traditions have preserved those. We can learn from that and stand on their shoulders and pick up where they left off rather than having to start from scratch ourselves. I also find that religion adds a dimension to life. You know, just like you could go through life without religion, you could go through life without, let's say, the arts, for example. But if you include, if you have those things, it adds a dimension. Religion includes meaningful celebrations and rituals and life cycle events to celebrate different stages of life. And very importantly, all religions include traditions and rituals having to do with end of life, with burial and mourning. Those are situations where an individual might not be sure what to do, how best to handle the situation, and especially at a very difficult time when you've just lost somebody, and then you have.
So Herman, let me just jump in because there's a lot there, as you say, and I know these rich topics could go on for hours, and we're somewhat limited. But I do want to at least flag a couple of points. Herman's absolutely right that Judaism in particular puts much less emphasis on an afterlife. Fair point, very important point, and the piece that we're referencing references that fact on its own. He's also talking about, Professor, imbuing meaning with end of life, imbuing meaning with rituals, traditions, gatherings. And that desire for community is also a very human instinct. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, Herman's making an important point there that probably shouldn't be ignored, that people do desire that meaning and that sense of community.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I think that's right. I think that's one of the, I mean, so there's a lot of things that Herman just said. I mean, of course, I agree with what Evan just said in terms of the plurality of religions. But focusing specifically on ritual, yeah, that's one of the great attractions of religion. In fact, even as an atheist who was raised in a Roman Catholic tradition, in some ways I appreciate the ritual of Roman Catholicism more now as an atheist than I did when I was struggling with all the theological and moral problems. But now that I've gotten past those, I could appreciate the ritual. But that sort of ritualistic bonding and community is available to all people, secular and religious alike. And that's just part of the human need. And yeah, for some people, religion fills that need. And for others, they find other ways. But I do agree that that's extremely important for the well-being of all of us as human beings.
Matthew?
So I would certainly agree that religion provides a meaning. I don't know that it's the only path to meaning. Not that I think that Herman was suggesting that. So, you know, I am what I would consider a very devout atheist. I'm also a regular churchgoer. I'm a member of a Unitarian church, and I, you know, find a lot of solace in the community there and in the rituals there. Maybe it would be better to separate out, you know, kind of belief in God from, you know, attendance of church or, you know, adhering to a religion, because they are kind of different things, and I think they often do get lumped together. But you certainly, you know, to celebrate milestones, to have traditions, to have rituals, those things are not exclusive to religion. Certainly, I think religion has, you know, a pretty strong, you know, basis, pretty strong adherence to those things. But, you know, we all have rituals. You know, my personal favorite that I think I've never found anyone else that does, my mother always, New Year's Eve, would put out quarters face up outside of every door to our house, and it was supposed to bring prosperity. There's no belief in a deity there. It's not associated with any religion. I still don't have an idea why she does it. I have even less idea why I still do it, except to adhere to the ritual and make me feel closer to her. So I appreciate that people do find, you know, meaning in this, but I don't think that's the only place that you find meaning.
Linda writes to us to say, hello, Evan and guests. It seems that your guests are drawing from a small stereotypical sample size of theists. I've derived much comfort from my faith practice and also know that life is finite. This inspires me to follow my purpose and make my part of the world a better place. If bad or evil happens because of a supreme being, then the same can be said of good or joyous events. I suppose I get annoyed by the patronizing attitude atheists have toward those who follow a faith tradition. That's from Linda in Penfield. Professor, I actually haven't heard much patronizing, but at the same time, I will say that Linda's got a right to feel that way. And the other point I would make is, I would encourage all people, atheists, spiritual existentialists, agnostics, theists, religiously devout people, to try to have a little bit thicker skin about this, because it's only the actual place of the universe that we're talking about. And a lot of these questions have governed policy. They govern how people are treated. They govern how governments are formed. Public norms. So I take the point, Linda. I hope you don't feel patronized. But I hope that we can debate ideas firmly. I hope we respect people, but ideas are not worthy of respect. People are. Ideas are worthy of scrutiny. Mm-hmm. So, but if she's feeling that way, I don't want her to feel that way. Professor, what would you say to Linda?
Yeah, I agree, of course. And, you know, I hope I'm not coming off as patronizing in any way. I think it's natural, though, for all of us to feel when there's something that is really sincerely important to us in a heartfelt way, to feel a bit put off and challenged, even by light criticism of that. I think we all have that in common, secular and religious folk alike.
It's about identity, right? I mean, a lot of our beliefs are tied to our identity.
Absolutely. Our ego, yeah.
And our identity, if it feels challenged, that's tough. How do you navigate that, Matthew, in your conversations?
Well, you know, certainly I hope I didn't, you know, say anything too offensive. I know I step on enough people's toes without meaning to, that I don't have to do it intentionally either. So when we talk about people being more or less likely to do these things, that's exactly, I think, what we're saying. And, you know, it's all just kind of, you know, philosophizing at this point. You know, there are people who are religious who, you know, I think... In the article, we talk about people who are religious who are acting in a secular manner. That doesn't make them not religious, and it doesn't make their religion not important to them. It just means looking at it from a different perspective, perhaps they have motives that they don't even realize.
And that may sound patronizing to some people, but I think it's a fair question, in the same way that it would be fair to ask atheists to kind of peel back some of their own actions.
Sure. Case in point, I mean, it's never just philosophizing.
Rick writes to us and says, Evan, as I listen to your guests, I'm reminded of a challenge I made to a Catholic priest I knew when I was 18 years old. I asked him, what if it all turns out that what you believe is false? There is no God, no heaven or hell. Wouldn't that make your decision to live your life according to the gospel a mistake? His response is one I have always kept in mind. He responded, what do I lose by living my life in a way that demonstrates love for others and all creation? I was surprised, but eventually came to understand that it is important to live life properly in the moment, not for eternal reward or punishment. If there is a heaven, that will be a bonus, but if not, then life can still have meaning and be fulfilling. I guess that is consistent with what your guests are saying, and it seems to make sense as a philosophy about life. That's from Rick. Do you agree, Professor?
Yeah, I don't want to, you know, blur too many distinctions here, but I think that whatever is most beautiful about religion, we have that in common with secular philosophy as well. That a love of life, a love of all of, whether you call it creation or just the universe, I think we have that in common. I'm hard-pressed to think of things that are of value in that sort of, for lack of a better sense, well, no, I won't call it spiritual, a sense of wonder. I am hard-pressed to think of anything that there isn't a secular counterpoint that's equally amazing and awe-inspiring over.
All right. Andy writes to us on Twitter and says, as a Buddhist, I find meaning and urgency in life because the Buddha taught that all things are impermanent and in flux, so we must appreciate things while they last. As for the idea that atheism imparts meaninglessness, all religions are just a way of making sense of a very complex and complicated world. Fear of atheism, I feel, stems more from a fear of not understanding others' beliefs. I follow the Dalai Lama, who said, kindness is my religion. That's from Andy. Do you find sometimes, Matthew, that people make assumptions about you if they find out you're an atheist?
Yeah, I certainly have. I've had, you know, very, very pointed conversations with people who I have known for a while when they find out that I'm an atheist. And I think the problem is that most religions have something in common. And that something they have in common, they don't have in common with atheism. There's a lot of common ground between religion. I know it's a gross oversimplification. But in some situations, it seems like the very fact that you don't share that with someone is offensive to them. And that's certainly not everyone. I have been, you know, very lucky to have very religious friends who accept me for who I am. But there are also people who get very upset with just the fact of the belief.
Back to your phone calls. David and Aurora next. Go ahead, David.
My complaint with nearly all the religions is that they destroy the mystery. I mean, no religion actually can really explain where it came from, why anything's going on, or where we're going. So, you know, including the Big Bang doesn't explain anything to me, you know. So that's my comment. Thanks.
David, thank you for the phone call. One of many different views shared this hour. And before we close the hour, my mind just got pulled in a direction I didn't expect. I thought of, and I hate to be this guy, but I'm going to recommend a TED Talk. But it really is the best TED Talk I've ever seen. And it was from a guy by the name of Tim Urban. It's actually on procrastination is what it's about. And it's really clever. And it's funny, but it's also poignant. And at one point, he makes a chart, and it's just a mark, little marks of every week that you'll have in your life if you live to age 90. And you see how many of the marks have already been blurred out and how many are left. And when you start looking at that, then that's just the weeks of your life. Then how about a mark for every time you're going to go home and visit your parents? Far fewer marks left, and we don't know how many of those are left. But when you look at it on a chart like that, you go, whoa. That urgency, you feel that. You feel, I can't help but think of Hagland. I can't help but think the next time I visit my mother could be the last time. Mm-hmm. I don't have a guarantee of an afterlife or an everlasting life. And to that end, I don't know that I'd want one. It doesn't mean I don't want more time with her. But that fills me with a sense of urgency that is profound. And it fills that interaction with her with even more meaning. And yeah, beauty. I mean, both of our guests have talked about beauty and awe in everyday actions, not just the flower that Gluck talked about. So as we close here, what are your thoughts on the urgency of time? How do you view, as an atheist, maybe a sense of meaning in the day-to-day that I don't know if you feel that you wouldn't have quite as much if you weren't an atheist?
Well, you know, I don't know. I think I want to have, and this is, I'm sure, consistent with the book we're talking about, but I want to have a sense of the meaningfulness of the ordinary. And, you know, Camus writes beautifully about that. And one of the people that I love the most to read, that I think if anyone wants to find somebody writing beautifully about the ordinary, they should read Walt Whitman's Song of Myself. He names the ordinary there and elevates it. And I think that's what we should strive to appreciate in our temporal finitude, just the beauty and abundance of the diversity and wonder that's just all around us in the ordinary.
Matthew.
It's probably really tacky to quote oneself, so I'm not going to quote, but I have a niece who had me perform her wedding ceremony last year. And one thing that I wanted to kind of let her and her husband know is, you know, kind of how finite life is and how really, you know, you don't know when your last day is going to be. And in relation to one another, you have no way of knowing what your last words to your loved one are going to be for most of us, and not knowing what words they're going to get to hear from you. So make all of your words as kind as possible and forgive as quickly as possible and live your life in a way that every moment is one that if it ended right then, you would be okay with it.
The urgency of forgiveness is another interesting theme. Boy, there's all these different threads that we could sort of unspool and take in different directions and spend, but that question of forgiveness and the urgency, I don't think Matthew is saying just forgive no matter what or for those who don't deserve it, but boy, do we hold on to grudges or pain for a long time. Forgiveness can be powerful. What about an amazing way to end the week. I want to thank our guests for being here. Matthew Brown is a family doctor who ditched his patients today. So if you're one of Matthew's patients, I want you to think about what your meaning and urgency feels like today, because your doctor would rather be on the radio. I'm mostly kidding. And I'm really grateful you're here, and I know they're grateful to have you as a doctor, and I hope you'll come back.
Thank you.
Matthew Brown, a family doctor in Rochester, also a member of the Fairport Village Trustees as well.
That's right.
Lawrence Torcello is an associate professor in the Department of Philosophy at RIT. It's never just philosophizing. Thank you for being here.
It's always fun.
Our thanks to Christine, the volunteer who does such great work with us on Fridays, and Rob Braden, the engineer. Megan Mack is the producer. I'm Evan Dawson. Have a beautiful weekend, wherever you are and whatever it looks like. And we'll talk to you Monday on Member Supported Public Radio.